Tom Woods Show, episode 1921.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody, check out the official coffee of The Tom Woods Show, Press House Coffee. You can have the best cup of diner-style coffee you've ever had, or you can try some of their amazing flavors, like my favorites, blueberry muffin and key lime pie. No chemicals to make those flavors. They just cleverly blend different kinds of coffee to yield these amazing results. Take 20% off your first order when you use promo code WOODS at PressHouseCoffee.com/WOODS. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. We are joined today by Unzube Udezwe, otherwise known as Zubi, who is many things. He's a rapper. He's a fitness expert. He's a podcaster. He's a social and political commentator. He is somebody I follow on Twitter and get tremendous enjoyment out of, by the way, because of the content he generates just on that one platform. That's where I first discovered him. And then I realized he has over 420,000 followers on Twitter. And I have yet to find a single thing out of this guy's mouth that I disagree with. So I thought, doggone it, it's been long enough. I should have this guy on the show. So that is precisely what we are doing right now. Zubi, welcome to the show.
How's it going, Tom? How are you doing?
I'm doing great. And I got to know you on Twitter. I don't know how I started following you, but boy, am I glad I did. I do more retweeting than original tweeting. But you, every day I get something that where I'm just saying, doggone it, I couldn't have improved on that. Or you have some observation, and I say, now that he's said it, now I can't say it. Now it's taken. You know, and a lot of times you make these observations where I think, yeah, that is exactly what's happening. You know, and I haven't quite put it that way, especially on the pandemic stuff. My gosh, have you been good and solid on that? And so, first of all, tell me, where do you live right now? Do you still live in England?
Yeah, I'm in the UK for now, although I'm planning to leave in about a month.
Oh, okay. Let's actually start there. Where are you heading?
It's a little bit up in the air right now. I mean, I'm going to end up in the USA this summer because I've got some speaking events in Texas and Florida booked so far, and I'll probably have some other stuff. I'm also planning to go out to Hawaii for a week because I've been asked to do a podcast and record some videos over there. So I'm certainly going to be in the USA in the summer. In terms of mid to longer term plans, that's a little bit up in the air and fluctuating. So I can't really reveal anything in that sense yet because there's a lot to be worked out. But yeah, I think this year is going to be it's going to be my last month in the UK for the foreseeable future. I'm sure I'll come back and visit from time to time, but I think it's time to head for different pastures.
Well, it's sad because as I'm sure somebody who lives there, you don't need to be told that there are many merits to that place. And I mean, I love being in London, and I am just heartsick at what's been done to London, just as I am about what's been done to California, although much worse over there. I, as a resident of Florida, will say that if you chose Florida, we would certainly welcome you with open arms. I'll just leave that. I'm not going to say anything further, but we would absolutely love to have you. Now, let's go way back, because you're born in the UK. You do not have an accent. You spent a lot of time as a young man living in Saudi Arabia, and apparently you went to an international school. Can you describe for us what that's like? Because probably almost no one can imagine what it would be like to live in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, sure thing. So first of all, where I lived was primarily an expat community. So I lived in a small town. They're actually called camps. And where I lived, there were only about 1,500 people in total. So people from all over the world, UK, USA, Canada, other Arabic countries, Asia, Africa, people from all over. So a very diverse community. Lots of Americans. I was in the American school system from kindergarten up until fifth grade. And then when I was 11 years old, I actually went to the UK for boarding school. So I've got a very varied upbringing with exposure to a lot of different cultures and nationalities. I've always been surrounded by all sorts of different people. In terms of my family background, my family's originally from Nigeria. Then, of course, I was born in England and I've lived in the UK now for a long time. I'm British by nationality. I've had very heavy exposure to Americans and American culture, and I was in the American school system for a long time. And then, of course, I lived in Saudi Arabia for a long time. So those are four very different cultures that I've had heavy exposure to. Beyond that, I've traveled to, I think, about 35 different countries so far. So I think it gives me a different perspective on the world. And you were talking before about my sort of analytics and observations. And I think the reason why people find my sort of commentary on various things interesting is largely because of that exposure and experience and having that range of perspective that most people don't necessarily have access to. And then I think that combined with my own personality just puts me in a very unique position where I think and I see and I observe things a little bit differently from most people. And I think that helps in everything from my music to my podcasts to what I do on social media.
What did your parents do for a living that brought you to Saudi Arabia?
My dad's a medical doctor. And my mom used to be a journalist. So my dad got an opportunity to go and work for the biggest oil company in the world out in Saudi Arabia. He got that job opportunity out in the, I guess it would have been the mid to late 80s. And he went over there and myself and my mom and my four older siblings all went out there. I don't remember that. I was a baby at the time. But yeah. We all went out there, family of seven, to Saudi Arabia, and that's where we were for the next couple decades.
Now, if you lived in an expat community, obviously your day-to-day experience is very different from somebody, you know, I guess maybe living in downtown Riyadh. Mm-hmm. So how often did you venture out from that community? And what, as a young man, were you surprised at what you saw beyond there?
No, I mean, I think it's worth saying that I wouldn't even have been a young man necessarily at this stage. I mean, I was a child. I moved to Saudi when I was 1 year old. And so I was there, you know, from the age of one, and I didn't move to the UK sort of permanently until I was 20. So Saudi Arabia is really home for me in a lot of ways. So I would venture out. I mean, we'd venture out, I know, once or twice a month and go into one of the main cities. So if you wanted to go shopping, for example, beyond the kind of regular groceries, then we'd normally go to a city called Al-Khobar, which is near Dhahran. And that's typically where you do shopping. There are other cities you'd go to, such as Hofuf, Dammam. People would go to different places. And so once you're outside of that little bubble, then yeah, you're in more like what I'd call real Saudi Arabia, which was fine. You know, I mean, compared to a Western perspective, of course, things are different. And I think things are very different even now compared to how they were when I was last there, which would have been in 2008. So I think in that past 12, 13 years, a lot of stuff has actually changed. So I'm really curious to go back and see what it's like now. But yeah, it was just a different culture. But you have to remember that with me, that's where I grew up. So it's more like when I came to the UK, I thought things were weird in the UK, you know, from having different days of the week. So in Saudi Arabia, the week runs from Saturday until Wednesday, and then Thursday and Friday is the weekend. So I remember when I came to the UK, it was weird having Saturday and Sunday as the weekend, because typically that would be the start of the week for me. And then just lots of different things, everything from the climate to the culture to the demographics to certain rules and laws. All of that stuff is just different. But for me, it was relatively normal because that's just how and where I grew up. Of course, within the expat community, some of the rules and regulations are different and more sort of free, shall we say. But you're still in Saudi Arabia and you simply respect that. And as long as you are respectful of it, then it's all good, really. In my experience, Saudi's an interesting country because it's one of those places that very few people have actually been to. But the majority of people seem to have very strong opinions about. It's not like that for most countries. And like with most things, there's a kernel of truth to some of that, but people also have a lot of prejudices and they make a lot of assumptions, mostly of which are incorrect. And it's a country that people tend to want to view and only talk about the negative side of things without appreciating that there are positive things in the culture and the way that they do things as well. It would be like looking at a country like the USA, which some people do this, right? And just looking at all of the negatives and looking at the problems and highlighting that as if that totally represents the USA or represents the American people, or looking at certain actions by the US government and assuming that's sort of representative of the 330 million Americans. And as you know, that's simply not true, right? There's a difference between a government and the people. So someone can criticize a government, and it doesn't mean you're criticizing the country as a whole or the people as a whole, et cetera. But I find that with countries like Saudi Arabia and perhaps even other Middle Eastern countries or just other foreign countries outside of the West, people sort of have this bias and, dare I say, arrogance sometimes, where they're really talking about things without knowing what it's like. And they're making a lot of assumptions and even conflating various things. You know, they'll be talking about something that happens in another country and they'll be assigning that to another country. And yeah, I don't know. People like to speak on things they don't necessarily know much about, but that's maybe just how people are.
Well, you spend a lot of time on Twitter, so I'm sure you see plenty of that.
Yeah, no shortage of it, you know. And none of us are perfect, but unless I know at least something about something, then I try not to hold extremely strong opinions about it until I've experienced or been educated to learn a little bit more about that. If I have strong opinions on something, it's typically because I know a lot about the subject and I've done some deep thinking into it, or I've even experienced it myself. But there are a lot of subjects that I actually just don't talk about at all, either because I don't want to, or just because I don't have a strong informed opinion on it. And so I don't want to just add to the noise and pretend that I know what I'm talking about on something that I don't.
Well, how about that? If only the other 99.9% of the world would follow that advice, the world would be a better place. Now, you're very well traveled. And I want to ask you a question. I want to preface it with this. In the United States, we had a year or so ago the death of an economist named Walter Williams, who maybe you're familiar with, but I don't know how well he was known beyond the U.S. But he was a great man and really knowledgeable and brave. And I asked him once, I had him on the show a couple times, and I asked him, does it bother you that here you are, this really accomplished PhD economist, and every time you're interviewed, all people want to ask you about is race relations, because you're black, so that's what we have you on to talk about, and you could talk about anything, and it's always that. Doesn't that annoy you? And he said, well, I guess it does a little bit, but I have strong opinions on this, so I'm happy to talk about it. So I've had people on the show, you know, who are non-white, and I have not even, the audience to this day doesn't even know that, because I refuse to be that guy who thinks, well, now I know everything there is to know about you, and there are five questions that you're going to be asked every single interview. I don't want to do that. But doggone it, you've been to 35 countries. You've lived in Saudi Arabia. Does that give you a perspective on race relations around the world? Like, has that given you any insight on that question?
It has. And it's told me that there are great people and bad people of all sorts. And I think everybody actually implicitly knows this, but sort of conveniently forgets it from time to time. The issue of race and ethnicity to me is something that is interesting in the sense that I think it's really cool that there are people of all sorts in the world. I actually think the diversity of human beings is very cool and interesting to an extent. Does it tell you much about how they think or what they believe or the content of their character or what's in their brain, what's in their heart? No, it doesn't. But it's just something that's interesting. You know, you meet someone and, okay, you know, they look different or they've got a particular accent, et cetera. It's like, okay, cool. You know, interesting. You know, where are you from? What's your family background? And everyone has a little different story. And that can, of course, have some influence on their culture, shall we say. But oftentimes, the sort of racial aspect of it is something that gets far too much emphasis. It's probably one of the least interesting things about people, like I said, beyond what they look like. You know, I think it's interesting. Someone can obviously see me, right? I'm British, but someone can see me and say, okay, well, this guy's clearly of African origin. So, you know, where are you from? Are you Nigerian? Are you Ghanaian? Whatever. I can say, yeah, you know, I'm from Nigeria. My family's originally from the Igbo tribe. This is kind of my ancestry, et cetera. And that's cool. And that's interesting. But in terms of who I really am or what I've accomplished or the way I think, what's in my heart, my personality, my character, simply knowing that I'm black or even knowing that I'm Nigerian doesn't tell anybody anything. And it sort of shouldn't. So I think that, I mean, this goes all throughout human history, right? I mean, the whole concept of racism itself has always been absurd to me from literally early childhood. I mean, you know, whenever I discovered it, I was like, okay, this is stupid because you're judging someone based on the sort of outer, I don't know, 2 millimeters of their epidermis. And that tells you nothing about anything about them. So racism itself is a stupid concept, but also the sort of racialism is also a stupid concept because it's still doing the same thing. And perhaps people may be saying it's doing it to counter racism, but I don't really believe that. I don't see people that way. You know, I've got eyeballs and I can tell what people look like, but just like I wouldn't make assumptions on someone based on their hair color or their eye color or their height, etc. Them looking a certain way in terms of their race or their ethnicity, beyond a mere point of interest, it doesn't mean anything to me. And I think that when people start obsessing over it or keep obsessing over it, more like it's, you know, it's just another way to divide people unnecessarily. I mean, the concept of race itself is a funny thing because we live in this time where, you know, people want to claim that certain things are social constructs, you know, such as gender. But the concept of race, yes, of course it has, you know, we have ancestors. So of course there is a biological component to what we consider race, you know, somebody being white or black or, you know, Asian, Arab, etc. But it's also sort of a social construct dating back to a long time ago. I mean, even what is considered white has changed over time, right? There was a time where Irish people were not considered white. There have been times even now where, you know, Jewish people are considered white sometimes, but not white other times.
Oh, look, I'm half Armenian. And okay. there was a debate in the United States as to whether we should be considered white.
Yeah,
and,
there you
and
go.
It barely came out that we're considered white. Like, what? This is kind of weird.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, what about people who are so-called mixed race? You know, what are they? You know, people talk black and white. It's like, well, you know, there's people who are both of these things. You know, even the concept that people call Barack Obama, you know, black. I mean, he's just as white as he is black. But if you said Obama is a white man, people will look at you like you're insane. If you say he's black, people are like, yeah, of course he's black. But he's actually, you know, it's 50-50, isn't it? So that in itself shows the social construct element. And I'm aware of the sort of history and the way that dates back. But if you sort of think about it rationally, it's pretty absurd. And again, it's just not a particularly useful delineation. You know what I mean? Like it doesn't really, who cares? It's just like, it's something that's just a way to divide people in the way that it tends to be used. And that is actually the intention. So it's something to me that's just there. But to me, it's very much like, you know, it's literally not far off somebody's like height or eye color or hair color, et cetera. It's just like, okay, these are just descriptors of a human being and might inform you a little bit about their heritage, but in terms of their personality, character, so on and so forth, literally doesn't tell you anything. And to assume it does is actually the basis of racism and racial prejudice.
Now, I don't know what the situation is like in the UK, but in the United States right now, there's a big debate over something called critical race theory. Mm-hmm. And race relations are, you know, I would say worse now than they were even just 15 years ago.
Agreed.
And there are people in the US who would say that maybe the salient feature of the United States is white supremacy or its history of racism, that is the distinguishing characteristic of it, which to me, I think is, let's say, an overstatement, to put it mildly. But all the same, I'm curious, though, even if there are people who I think people who are peddling a line like that are not really looking to bring about reconciliation. I think they're looking to stoke problems and dislike and suspicion among people. But that doesn't mean that the idea that you might actually experience ill treatment because of your race is a myth. No doubt that does happen to people. So can you recall in your own life when the first time something like that happened to you was?
That's a good question. I think I remember when I was about 6 years old, I came to the UK. And I came to the UK for a vacation. And I remember that I was I don't even know, it wasn't a school. I was in some sort of like youth group or something like that. And I remember I was the only black kid. And I remember literally just out of pure ignorance slash naivety, some of the other kids asking me why my skin color was like that, or even why my lips were thicker than theirs. And this is literally, you know, you're talking 5 or 6 year olds. So, you know, there's someone who could probably make a big deal about this and say, oh my gosh, woe is me. You know, this traumatized me for the rest of my life. But it's like, no, you know, this is just, you know, this is childhood curiosity. Like, these kids obviously have never come across someone who looks like me before, and they're curious. I've had the same thing. I've been to plenty of countries in Central and Eastern Europe. I've been to places where, you know, I remember when I was in Serbia and I met some teenagers, and I was literally the first Black person they'd ever met in real life. And so they were just curious, right? Like, there was no hostility or whatever. They were just genuinely curious. Like, oh, we've never seen someone who looks like this besides on TV. And so they were asking me various questions. So I'd say that sort of incident would have been the first thing that I remember sort of someone making any kind of deal about it. When I was in literally preschool from the age of 3 or 4, you know, like I said, I was surrounded by diverse people. I had people in my class who were everything from, you know, Nigerian, Arab, Mexican, white Canadian, American, white American and Black American and Asian American, Asian, people just from all over. So to me, from the very beginning, all of my friends, people I know, family, friends, whatever, it's always been a big, big mix of people. So I think that experience in the UK was the first time as a child I was like, oh, okay, there are some people who are sort of, this is totally new to them. So that was probably like my first experience. I wouldn't even really call it racism. Someone might want to, but it was just, I think, childhood curiosity more than anything else.
You seem very gracious toward others in answering questions like this. And yet there are others who aren't that way, who seem to see racism and ill will at every turn. How do you account for why you have a different perspective?
I'm not very emotional. I think that helps with a lot of things. I'm literally in the bottom 2% of the whole population in terms of a personality trait called neuroticism, which is based on sensitivity to negative emotion and volatility. Like, I'm just very chilled and I always keep a calm, rational head even when other people are losing theirs. So I think that's a part of it. I'm literally just far less sensitive than most people. Doesn't mean I'm totally emotionless, but I can experience the same thing that someone else does and they'll make some giant deal about it and it'll be affecting them for weeks, months, or even years. Whereas with me, I barely notice it, or even if I do notice it, I just shrug it off. This has happened with lots of various situations. I mean, to give you a good example, in 2009, I was arrested at gunpoint in the UK. I was coming off of a train and there was a situation of mistaken identity. I came off a train and a whole firearms unit of police with dogs and carbine rifles and everything literally rolled up on me, pinned me to the ground, handcuffed me, frisked me, you know, arrested me, put me in a cop car, took me to station. Keep in mind, I've done absolutely nothing wrong. I don't even know what's going on. And, you know, it was massive news in the UK. It was in all the papers. It was everywhere. And there are a zillion people who, number one, would be totally traumatized by that for a long period of time. And there are people who would have jumped to use that as an example of all kinds of racism and prejudice and bigotry and said, you know, this happened to me because I'm a Black man, this and that, and this and that. And when the true facts came out, it turned out that it didn't have, you know, very little to do with racism. There's a potential that someone racially, one cop who's passed the information on to the arresting officers, you know, racially profiled me in some sense. But in terms of certainly the arresting officers, so on and so forth, you know, it had nothing to do with me being a young Black man. But if you look at the optics of it, someone's mind who thinks like that would jump to that. I mean, another example, I mean, that's my own experience there. But I mean, taking something that happened last year, you know, the George Floyd situation, which virtually everybody, regardless of political orientation, agreed was a tragedy and was something that was awful and very hard to watch and shouldn't have happened. But there's no evidence to this day, there is no evidence that that had anything to do with racism, right? And it upsets some people when I say that, but that's simply a fact, right? When people see that and they jump immediately to the racial narrative, that is their own cognitive error and bias, right? I'm not saying that it's impossible that there was any racial motive, but to this day, even after the court proceeding has happened, you know, racism was never even brought up by the prosecution as a charge. But when people talk about it, talk about this issue, they will literally use that issue as an example of police racism or racism in America or systemic, institutional, structural racism, et cetera, with zero evidence that that's the case. And then they'll make crazy claims like, well, this only happens to Black people. And I'm like, I can pull up a video of a white man named Tony Timpa. I can pull up a video of Daniel Shaver. I can pull up, you can pull up lots of situations where the exact same thing has happened to white people. In fact, white people in the US are killed by police more. Most people don't even know that. People don't even know the names of a single person, yet they can name you several Black people who have been killed, and they'll use those as examples of racism. And this is just, you know, human beings are subject to all sorts of cognitive flaws, you know, confirmation bias, cognitive dissonance, groupthink. There are a lot of cognitive errors that people constantly and consistently make, partially based on their own emotions. And I try not to be totally subject to that, right? None of us are perfect. We all have our own biases, but at least by being aware of them, you can become a much clearer, more rational thinker. And like I said, you can keep your head whilst everyone else is losing theirs and try to be, you know, none of us are perfectly objective, but you can be a little bit more objective about these various situations and not jump to conclusions and create your own narratives or confirm your own narratives based on what is convenient at the time.
My father was falsely arrested for arson. I don't think I've ever said that on the show, back when I was about 5 years old. And it was psychologically for him really devastating. I mean, it was humiliating. And it's interesting that now as a libertarian, you know, I have, let's say, kind of unorthodox views about the police. But that didn't really affect me at the time. When I was a kid, I just thought, well, in this particular case, the police made a mistake, and that particular policeman ought to answer for that. Yes. But my father did try to take legal action. But going after the police, even when they wrong you, mm-hmm. is just overwhelmingly difficult, no matter who you are and what race you are, just yes. because of the way the system is.
Yeah, you know, and that's more of a problem in itself than any so-called institutional racism in the police force. You know, if people want to talk about police misconduct or police brutality in certain cases, then let's have that conversation. But to turn it primarily into a racial issue is people just missing the point and conflating things and making, you know, that's part of why a lot of problems don't get solved, is because people are really bad at the diagnosis, right? So people are running around trying to solve the wrong issue, or occasionally even trying to solve an issue that's not an issue or literally does not exist. And we see this all the time. So if people could be a little bit calmer and more reasonable and keep their wits about them, then I think we'd actually be able to solve some of these problems. Because there's no doubt that, you know, especially in the USA, and it's a big country, and I understand that it's complicated. You know, you've got a very widely armed population, for one. So policing in the USA is, you know, more dangerous. And there are certain neighborhoods which are more dangerous than most parts of the UK or even Europe. And so if we're going to talk about those issues, I think we need to be able to, you know, if we're going to change anything, you know, if you want to fix a problem, you need to be able to diagnose the problem first. And if your answer to everything is systemic racism, systemic racism, systemic racism, then you're never going to solve the issue, and you're not going to get people on board either, because people are going to feel different types of way about it. One of the dumbest arguments that you see all the time, and this really peaked in the last summer, was, you know, this whole debate between and this has gone on for years. I mean, the whole debate between people saying Black Lives Matter or people saying All Lives Matter, and then getting at each other's throats about that. I'm like, you guys are both saying the same thing, just in slightly different ways, right? There's no reasonable person on earth who does not implicitly agree with the meaning of those statements, right? Everybody agrees that Black Lives Matter, right? I didn't need activists last summer, you know, putting black squares on their Instagram or putting Black Lives Matter in their bio to let me know that my life matters and my family life matters and, you know, Black Lives Matter in general. It's like, yes, thank you. I've been aware of that my whole life. I didn't need that education. And then you get people who get triggered when they hear All Lives Matter, which obviously includes Black lives, but it includes everybody else. And I think it shows the immaturity of our society and the immaturity of people's conversations when they get lost in the weeds having a 2-hour debate about whether the phrase all lives matter is racist, or the phrase Black Lives Matter is racist, or whatever. It's like, look, what are you guys talking about? Like, are you trying, do you want to stop police brutality? Okay, then, you know, let's talk about certain issues, you know, whether or not, I don't know the exact policies, but okay, let's talk about the, you know, from what I know about the US system, you know, like, let's talk about training. Let's talk about qualified immunity. Let's talk about, you know, body cams. Let's talk about this. Let's talk about that. But once you get dragged into these weeds of literally debating between the words black and all, then you've already lost.
Hey, everybody, let's take a quick break to thank our amazing sponsor, the official coffee of The Tom Woods Show. The way you start your day as a Tom Woods Show listener, not listening to The Tom Woods Show, drinking your Press House coffee. This is the coffee that turned me into a coffee drinker. And they have a simple mission at Press House. They want to make it as easy as possible to enjoy the best cup of coffee you've ever had. And they've got something for everybody, from rich, chocolatey, and nutty dark roasts to fruity and vibrant light roasts. And with Press House's all-new Daily Grind, the battle between fresh and convenient is finally over. Daily Grind is 2 weeks' worth of Press House's most popular coffees, perfectly portioned, ground, and sealed at peak freshness, no matter how you like to brew or how much you like to brew at a time. Rip it, dump it, brew it. That's it. No guesswork, measuring, or noisy grinders necessary. Subscribe and 10 more pouches will be at your doorstep right before you run out every time. It's time to ditch the K-Cup for a way better cup. Go to PressHouseCoffee.com/woods and click Daily Grind to change the way you coffee for good. Use promo code WOODS at checkout for 20% off your first order. That's PressHouseCoffee.com/woods. Let's talk for a few minutes about your experience at Oxford. What impressions can you give us just overall about the experience, and then also about the political climate?
Sure. So Oxford is a beautiful city, a very beautiful city, very beautiful university, a lot of history, a lot of prestige. And if you've ever been to the city of Oxford, then you'll know it's got a sort of, you know, it's got a little bit of a magical feel to it in a way. A lot of people go there and say, oh, wow, it looks like Harry Potter. And it's like, yeah, well, I believe that's where they film it. I've never actually seen the movies, funnily enough. But I think they film in Christchurch, if I'm correct. So Oxford was a great experience. I didn't necessarily love the subject that I did. So I'm a computer science graduate. So I wasn't super crazy about my subject, but I loved the city. I did like the university, made a lot of good friends there, had some great opportunities, et cetera. So it was a great environment for me. In terms of the political climate, it was normal. You know, I was in Oxford from 2004 to 2007. This is prior to any form of woke-ism, as we call it now, or prior to that, SJW-ism, et cetera. Those things had not really reared their ugly heads as they have now in modern Western society. And people were normal. People were not at each other's throats over these various divisions. People were not inventing new genders. People were not talking about white privilege and black oppression, et cetera, so on and so forth. And yeah, honestly, it was a lot more sane than it is now.
Yeah, by the way, I also went to an elite school, and my impression is that although we had people with some oddball views, and that tended to be the majority of speakers who would come to the school, and you know, people who agreed with me were in very much in the minority, I would much, much rather be on a college campus 30 years ago than I would now. Like, I don't even want to go and be a guest speaker somewhere, given the environment. But at the same time, I think... Yeah, you can find some conservative, you know, a handful of conservative colleges in the U.S. But apart from those, I actually think the weirdness and the craziness and the loons, they tend to have less representation at the elite schools simply because the elite schools have a genuine reputation to uphold. And they really do need to focus on research and real things and not that. So you also have that going for you.
Mm. And there's also less social sciences. You know, you can't study sociology in Oxford. You can't
study, is that so?
You can't study gender studies. You can't study, you know, black studies or whiteness studies or all this other nonsense. Like, those aren't even subjects. So if you're going to Oxford, then you're probably doing a real degree.
How did you go from music at, computers at Oxford into music?
I started making music when I was in my first year at university, and I released my first album when I was in my second year. So I actually started rapping when I was in Oxford. So that's actually the beginning of my career. So yeah, I started just as a hobby, doing it for fun. And then within 10 months, I had my first album out. I put it out there independently and had some good success with it. My first album actually sold 3,000 copies completely independently, 100% self-released, self-promoted, self-sold. And that sort of put me on the map, and it sparked the idea in my brain of, okay, this is something that I can do as more than just a hobby. People are paying me for my music. I'm doing gigs. People are enjoying what I'm doing. And so after I graduated, I did my music full-time for 1 year. And then I moved to London and I started working in London. I worked in the corporate world for 3 years. And then in November 2011, I took the jump. I said, hey, I'm going to go do my music full-time. And I've now been self-employed for almost 10 years.
So you do that. You also have a podcast. You're also in fitness. And you seem to me to be a one-man operation. Like you're running all this and promoting yourself and building up 420,000 Twitter followers and all that. As far as I can see, entirely on your own.
Yep. That's correct.
Yeah. How about that? Now, isn't that, I mean, I this is the pot calling the kettle black, as they say, because I am a podcaster myself, but there's something precarious about that existence though, right? It's different from when you worked in the corporate world, you were always going to get that paycheck at the end of the month or whatever. And you don't have that kind of guarantee when you're out on your own.
No, you don't. But that's also what makes it both scary and exciting. And it's why most people don't do that. You know, most people are not wired entrepreneurially and don't have the personality traits and even, you know, I guess the courage, which is linked to that, to go out and set off on their own. But for some people, that is the right path. It doesn't necessarily even feel that much like a choice. It's kind of like, I have to do this. I'm not designed to be in the corporate world. I'm not designed to be even in the music world. All right, I'm independent. You know, I don't work with a label. I don't have some manager above me and all these people in the music industry, you know, guiding me and coaching me and telling me what to do. I mean, if I did, I'd be getting them ringing me panicked every 5 minutes telling me to delete my tweets and my social media posts. So I'm very glad I don't have that. But I have a natural, how would I put it? I have a respect for authority that I respect, but I'm not a huge fan of, I like yourself, I'm very libertarian minded, not just politically, but also sort of personality wise. I don't like being told what to do, especially by an authority that I don't particularly respect, nor have a reason to respect. And so, you know, the notion of me needing, as a grown man, needing to ask another man to, you know, go on a holiday or to do this or to say that or to do that, I'm like, I can't work like that. You know, I'm just not wired to be that way. And so I love the fact that I'm self-employed and I'm independent and I don't need to answer to anybody. I can put out whatever music I want. I can put out whatever podcast I want. I can say what I want on social media. I can do what I want. If I want to disappear for the next 6 months and just go to Thailand, then I can. You know, nobody is there over me saying, no, you can't do that. You can't do this. You can't do that. And that sort of freedom is extraordinarily valuable to me.
Do you keep music and politics separate?
No, definitely not on this upcoming album.
Oh, tell us. Oh, let's get the details.
Yeah, so my new album, Word of Zuby, is it's absolutely my most everything album to date. I think it's my most positive and my most uplifting and my most inspiring, but it's also my most honest, my most political, and my most one, you know, it's full of the most real talk of everything that I've ever put out there. You know, if you like the stuff I talk about on podcasts, in interviews, on social media, etc., then you're going to get a lot of that on this album because the world has been in a weird place for the past several years. My last album came out in early 2019, and so much stuff has happened both in the world and in my personal life and in my career and overall success since that time that there's just been so much for me to talk about. So just like I put my thoughts out there on Twitter, I very much did the same thing on this album. And it's dope.
And you have a larger audience now than you did for your other albums.
Oh, man, by miles. It's not even comparable. I mean, you have to remember, I mean, you were talking about me having 420,000 plus Twitter followers. You have to remember at the beginning of 2019, I had 18,000. No, I had 15,000.
What do you attribute that to?
Becoming the British women's deadlift champion.
Oh, okay. All right. I knew this had to come up.
It was a catalyst.
Tell people about that.
Yeah, sure. So on the 26th of February, 2019, I posted a 9-second video on Twitter saying something along the lines of, I keep hearing about how biological men have no strength advantage over women in 2019. So watch me destroy the British women's deadlift record without trying. P.S. I identified as a woman whilst lifting the weight. Don't be a bigot. So I posted that to 18,000 followers at the time. It was a 9-second video of me doing a 230-kilogram deadlift. And I thought, okay, this is funny. It's probably going to get a couple hundred likes and a few retweets. Next thing I know, this video is going bananas. It's going absolutely insane. It had about 10,000 views within the first 10 minutes. Within the first hour, I think it had cracked 50 or 70,000 views. This thing just kept going and growing. Following morning, up to 500,000 views. I'm starting to be contacted by various media channels, Fox News, BBC, Sky News, The Daily Telegraph. All these people want to talk to me about this deadlift and this whole transgenderism in sports issue. And this just carried on. It kept going and going. Joe Rogan discovered it, talked about it on his podcast for several weeks. I was just gaining, I mean, Twitter-wise, I was gaining like 100 followers. Wait, is that right? Yeah, I was gaining about 100 followers an hour for several weeks. It just kept going and kept growing. I mean, I went from 18,000 to 50,000 within a couple of weeks. And then I got the opportunity to go out to the USA and I appeared on the Rubin Report, the Ben Shapiro Show, the Joe Rogan Experience, Tucker Carlson. I got invited to the Pentagon, to the White House. Like, I just kept that fire going because so many people discovered me initially off of that. But then they stuck around because they were like, oh, this guy makes dope music. Oh, he's got a podcast. Oh, he's cool. He's funny. He's interesting. He's got a lot of unique perspectives. So a lot of people, that was the kind of gateway into discovering me. But then they've stuck around ever since and everything continues to grow well beyond the virality of that particular post because people discovered me and they like what I have to offer the world. It's not at the same scale, but it's not too dissimilar to how the fact that if you remember how Jordan Peterson blew up, it was because of his opposition to Bill C-16. You know, at the time, he was a relatively unknown professor. And then within a few months, he's suddenly on Joe Rogan and he's on this and he's on that. And people like what he's about. And they're like, yo, I like this Jordan Peterson guy. And they discover his YouTube channel, which he's had up for a long time. And so oftentimes you just need that flashpoint for people to discover you. And then once people do discover you, if you've got something of value to offer them, then they stick around.
I didn't have anything quite like that, but I did have a couple of videos that went insanely viral about COVID. Mm. And so I had a lot of people follow me for that. And the same sort of thing, they followed me for that, but then they realized, I'm kind of interested in the other things this guy does. So they came for COVID, and now I've kept them here and propagandized them about libertarianism. So it's worked out just great for me. All right, a couple of things. I told you I would only keep your 45 minutes, so let me more or less keep that promise. Two quick things. Number one, when's that album coming out, do you think?
So it is now available to pre-order from my website exclusively, teamzuby.com. If you go to teamzuby.com, that's Z-U-B-Y, then you can now pre-order my album on digital download, CD, or vinyl. I'm doing a limited run of purple and gold color vinyl. There's only going to be 500 ever available. So you can pre-order that right now at teamzuby.com. And then in the next couple of months, within the next 2 months, I'm going to have a wider release on iTunes, etc. But if you want to get it right now and you want to be one of the first people in the world to get it, then head over to teamzuby.com.
All right. I want to get you back when the album comes out. We'll try and give it a nice push if you don't mind coming back.
Awesome.
And then the second thing is, I'm just curious, really quickly, who would you say are your musical influences?
My two favorite rappers are Tech N9ne and Jay-Z. I'm also influenced by Eminem, Kanye West, Gangstar, Mobb Deep. I feel like I'm missing a big one. Nas, Tupac. Influenced by quite a few people. There's a lot of rappers I like, but I'd say those are some of my biggest influences.
Okay, good, good, good. Now, it's sort of a principle of marketing that you give out only one link, because if you give out too much, the irony is that, or the paradox is that no one does anything. You give too many links, no one goes to any of them. Yeah. But at the same time, you do have a website that, because the teamzuby.com has got your merch, it's got your fitness book, Strong Advice, it's got your music and stuff. But then you have a main website, which also will have your podcast and the other things you do.
That's right.
That's zubymusic.com. Mm-hmm. If there's anything else you want to tell people about, go ahead.
Yeah, that's all good. I mean, you can find links to everything there. You can find me on all social media at Zuby Music, Zuby Music. I'm on Twitter, Parler, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, everything Zuby Music.
All right. So I'll have that stuff also up on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/1921. Well, this was great. I'm glad to get to know you and hear the voice behind Now I'm going to hear all these tweets in this voice. I'll know how to read them. but it's like every day I see you. You know, I see you on Twitter, and I have this. You know, for a while I went through this stupid phase where I was following everybody back, and you know, I ain't no Zuby. I've only got 108,000 followers on Twitter, but you know, for a dissident voice like me, I'm pretty content with that. But I followed everybody back for a while. And so I have this ridiculously clogged Twitter feed, but somehow you managed to get through every single day. So keep on doing that. The world definitely needs it. And thanks so much for your time.
I appreciate it, Tom. Thank you.
All right, folks, that's it for this week. Next week, we're going to kick off the week with Adam Curry. You may remember him if you're my age growing up. You may remember him as an MTV VJ. He now co-hosts the outstanding No Agenda podcast, and there'll be plenty of things to talk about with him. Remember, at the Tom Woods Show 2000th episode event in Orlando in October, which you are still wondering, should you attend? Of course, the answer is yes. There's no reason that that's going to ever possibly turn out to be a bad decision for you. I want to remind you that if you are a member of the Supporting Listeners program, you get to attend a special reception immediately before the event, and we're going to have a ton of fun there. Just you elite people and me, and then we'll all go to the big event together. But that's a private event just to say thank you to all you good supporters out there. And the super elite supporters at the platinum level and above even get a super deluxe reception before the reception. And this one is held in the hospitality suite with all the special guests, with Michael Malice and all the other lunatics I'm having for the 2000th episode event. You get to hang around with all of us. So get all the details at TomWoods2000.com. And if you want to join that Supporting Listeners program, I mean, I'm always just throwing extra bonuses in, like coming to my house, which I've done a couple of times. And there's a ton of food and entertainment and socializing and lots of fun to be had. So you want to be part of the elite, don't you? So SupportingListeners.com is how to do that. And then to register for the 2000th episode event, TomWoods2000.com. See you next week.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.